Hey there, Freedom Fighters. I'm Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And today's guest is a developer who found monetization so painful that he created a company that does it better. When Blake Comager created apps like Zombies and Vampires, he had a hard time getting revenue with his creations. So he built MediaSpike, the company I invited him here to talk about. It's a platform for product placement in social and mobile games. We're going to find out how he built it, and we're going to do it all thanks to my friend Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. He is the startup's lawyer, but I'll tell you more about him later. First, I want to welcome you, Blake. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, one cool thing in your background is that you've gotten to meet a lot of your heroes. You got to actually meet and work for one of many of our heroes, Sean Parker. What was it like to work for Sean Parker back when you were at Facebook?
I wasn't at Facebook. I worked with him at Plaxo.
Oh, Plaxo, the company that he built before Facebook.
Exactly. And then I worked with him again, actually, on Causes. So we were building on Facebook's platform.
Okay.
So we were one of those early companies there, but we weren't actually a part of Facebook. But the first time I worked with Sean was actually at Plaxo, and it was great. One of the things that I know this is overused. You hear, you know, this adjective thrown around, and I realize doing so loses its meaning, but there are very few people I would say actually have vision. And Sean has just this uncanny, insight into the future.
Give me an example of it, because you're right. It is used a lot, but when we see it right, when we see that vision, it's impressive sometimes. Give me an example of what he saw and how he communicated it.
So one of the things that he saw early on within Plaxo was the potential for us to be the social identity of the web. Right. And, you know, sure enough, I would say that, you know, while Plaxo may not have realized that vision, his very next company, Facebook, did. Right. And in many ways. And it's generally regarded as that is your social identity. And, it's one of those things that looking back, you realize just how insightful it was as he was described these things about, you know, how, you know, the internet needs this identity layer, right? And how it's lacking, and how, you know, Plaxo is the opportunity to create this layer. And it's really one of those things, like, it sounds very abstract, and it can be very difficult for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. But then when you see the realization of that vision through a company like Facebook, you realize just how, you know, ahead of the time that was, because this was back in like 2002, 2003 timeframe that he was talking about this. And it, you know, we're talking, it's probably, you know, 5 or 6 years before Facebook started really, you know, making headway into the realization of that vision.
But Plaxo started out, I remember it, as the online address book that your friends help you keep up to date. You upload your whole address book to it, right? Or it grabs the whole address book, and then it emails everyone on that list and says, hey, I'm trying to update my address book. If this information that I have on you is right, let me know. If it's not, edit it for me. And then people can go and edit the phone number, change the spelling of their names if it's wrong, add home addresses, and so on. Was it after that that he started to communicate to you that he wants Plaxo to be the online identity that we all use? Or was it when that was starting to fade?
It was as Plaxo first started growing. I mean, it began as a problem that was it was largely inspired by his own problems from Napster, right? Which was, okay, you have enormous number of contacts that had become a part of his life, and maintaining that address book was unwieldy. It was, you know, tens of thousands of people, right? That he wanted to have accurate info, and nothing's more frustrating than like, oh, here's someone that I would love to, you know, I haven't spoken to in 6 months, but they'd be the perfect person to connect you to. And, it's not unusual, especially in the startup world, for that person to have new contact info for whatever reason, right?
Okay.
And so that initial problem is what Plaxo was designed to first attack. But then as, you know, Plaxo began, began to start growing, and I mean, I was early at Plaxo, I wasn't at the very, very beginning. So I think there was something like 30,000 users on Plaxo at the time. which you know may sound small now, I guess, as you talk about things. But you know, for consumer tech at that time, it was like, wow, this is a successful thing starting to take off. And that was the point at which, you know, when I joined, I heard him already at that point articulating, you know, hey, here's this opportunity for social identity on the internet. Because you can imagine, you know, one of the things Plaxo did is it kept, you know, the vision was, you know, okay, it should keep a single record for each individual person. And that should be your, you know, your identity record that is like, look, this has your real phone number, your real email address, if your work email address changes, it shouldn't be that everybody out there now has to then, you know, say, oh, now Blake works at this company, so I'm going to update it. It should automatically update everybody.
Blake updates it and everyone else gets the corrected.
Exactly. So that you can always.
Why didn't Plaxo work as an insider? Why do you think?
You know, that's such a hard question. It was a wonderfully talented team. I still am very close to a lot of the team there, and actually a number of them actually participated in our most recent round. Very talented, very very intelligent team. Many of whom have gone on to build many other things, many other companies, you know, including
things
like...
That's what I mean.
Like,
very talented team, very smart, vision was spot on. Why didn't it work? As an outsider, I always thought it didn't work because the virality was so good that we were starting to all email all of our friends with these Plaxo updates. And so our friends associated Plaxo not with the online identity that they should have had, but with the email that they were getting from all these different sources.
And I think, you know, that certainly could have been part of it. Like we did run into a PR problem, right? And in that we, many of the techniques we were using, at the time we considered them pioneering, and we were very like, oh, here's a very intelligent thing to do, and you know, here's this idea, let's execute on it. And we, you know, the argument, did we overreach, could certainly be made. And, you know, then you end up with a bit of a market perception problem. You know, for us, you know, we viewed the company very differently because, you know, while other people viewed it perhaps as, you know, hey, that's that thing that I receive a lot of email about, we viewed it as, oh my God, we're going to fix the internet, right? This is, just, you know, and I know that sounds very, you know, self-important, but at the time, I mean, it's still an ongoing problem. Like, it's ridiculous that sometimes, you don't have someone's contact info that one when they want you to, right? Like, if I had my way, there's, you know, easily, you know, a couple thousand people on the planet that I'm like, no matter what, I want you to be able to reach me, you know?
No doubt. The closest that we get to that is Facebook, where people's phone numbers really are updated in real time, but it's not enough. It's not where we need to be. One more question about that part of your life. You work for a guy who, I think he's a billionaire now. He's clearly one of the biggest, most impressive visionaries in the tech space. What's one thing that you took away from working with him that you still think about today? One thing that you still apply?
I think one of the things that I personally like I had an instinct around this, and I struggled with it. And that's, I'm one of these people that, like, if I see something that looks wrong, I will fixate on it, and it's very very difficult to. You know, when one little thing is off, it's very difficult for me to see the forest for the trees, right? And that's something I saw Sean dealt with as well. And there were times when, you know, my instinct was to say, oh, this needs to be moved, or that's just a little bit too ugly. We absolutely have to fix this, and I would fixate on that. Part of me felt that, you know, chasing those details was one of those things that I'm like, all right, that's not the ideal use of time. I need to be thinking only about the big picture. And while in many ways, yes, you know, that big picture is very important, it's the sum of small details is very important too. And seeing that, you know, he would do that same thing, and that, you know, I was in an environment where, you know, many people agreed, like, oh yeah, that is important. We do need to make this, you know, every little bit of polish, every little bit of, you know, beauty is important in a product. Carrying that with me really helps. And it's stark just how much that impacts you.
Do you have an example of a time that you were impacted by it, or a decision that you made based on that?
Causes is a great example. Mm-hmm. So while working on Causes, And this is an incredibly biased opinion to hold, I know, but when Facebook opened up their platform, one of the things that was fantastic about that is actually Sean's company, which at the time wasn't called Causes, it eventually became Causes, was working on a nonprofit fundraising website. The idea being it would be, a separate social network and have widgets on, say, Friendster, Facebook, MySpace,
MySpace.
etc. This was
Yep.
2006, right? MySpace was big.
So if I wanted to raise money for a good cause, I could put the widget on my MySpace page and allow all my friends to help out.
And the reason and what and sh the company that I had started was called Care Badges. It was actually doing that, and it was growing pretty fast on MySpace at the time. Sean and I started talking about this, and he's like, "Well, I'm working on this one part of the problem. You're working on this other. We really should, combine forces." And when we did so, my that you know because of Sean's relationship with Facebook, we were able to, be a be a very very early beta developer on Facebook's platform, and we probably had a good 6 month lead on the vast majority of other people that did. And as a result, frankly, when you saw Facebook open their platform at launch, vast majority, and I knew this going in, and I knew this long before we launched, there were most of what we saw were just kind of like translations of widgets on MySpace. So you see things like these shitty horoscope apps, right? It was just a widget, right? And other things like photo slideshows, things that were very much so, I would say, not even apps yet, they were just widgets. Whereas Causes was an incredibly mature and polished application that had far more functionality than was necessary to make it set apart from the other like kind of like shitty widgets that people were doing.
Yes.
But and we knew that like months before Facebook's platform launched, we knew whatever other people what they were and what they were going to launch with, and that didn't mean that we rested on our laurels. It was still like 14, 16-hour days for those last several months just to add as much polish as we could and to make Causes on Facebook just the most we really wanted it to be like as make it look as I guess as embedded and as part of a Facebook and as we possibly could.
So much so that people actually assumed that Causes was owned by Facebook.
Yes, that was probably one of the most common misconceptions. People would send us email, for Facebook support problems, like I lost my Facebook password,
Help me out.
and yeah, and it was pretty crazy. And that level of integration and that level of polish, just absolutely propelled us, onto a growth trajectory that much faster than, really we even needed. But
Okay.
I still very, very proud of that. And I think it really, really paid off.
You then went on to create your own apps that had more than 50 million players, you say. What were these apps that you created for yourself?
So these were horror-themed games. These were the first social games on Facebook. So just 2 weeks, or actually not even full 2 weeks after Facebook had opened their platform, one weekend I created a game that I thought would be very entertaining, and it was very lightweight in design. But I took what I knew about viral marketing, which at this point I've been at Plaxo and working on Care Badges and then Causes. I had a lot of domain expertise around viral marketing, not a lot of domain expertise around game mechanics and good game design. So I took what I knew, which was viral marketing, and made it into a set of game mechanics. And
Can you give me an example?
yeah, absolutely. So honestly, the very first version of the zombie game, there were very few mechanics. There was a leveling mechanic, and then a recruitment mechanic. And the recruitment mechanic lined up with the zombie myth, and it was okay, I'm going to bite a friend, and that was an invite. You received a notification that
So
said you.
basically, you gave points for virality. I see. And
And
what was the other mechanic you said?
so
Viral and
a leveling up mechanic.
leveling up.
So that actually allowed you, the reward for doing that, other than just the entertainment factor, was that you actually progressed in the gameplay.
Interesting. Okay.
And in doing so, you received a more powerful, zombie, right? And the fascinating thing to me was, so horror, let's see, in 2007, especially like zombie horror films, they have a very, very passionate and loyal user base.
Yep.
And in my mind, it was a smaller user base than actually came to be. Some people, you know, said that when I did that on Facebook, the zombies and vampires, it really brought those two myths more mainstream for American culture.
Your games made it more mainstream.
Yeah.
You're building this up, though, and I could see the excitement of getting to millions of players, to seeing people bite each other and interact with all your ideas. The monetization issue is what led you to the business that we're talking about today. What did you try for monetization when you said, I need to start to make money?
Right. So several things. One of the fantastic things about games is your users are fixated on gameplay. A very unfortunate corollary for me at the time was that they exhibit far worse banner blindness than any other content I'd ever seen. So one of the dirty little secrets about growth is that even organic growth is not free, because you have server costs and engineering costs. And so 50 million players is not cheap. And I was looking at ad revenue from banners like this and a server bill that was going like this. So it wasn't calculus that led me to believe it was, you know, it was like, okay, let me just keep drawing that line. And okay, shit, in about 2 months, I'm going to be losing a lot of money. So I tried several things. All of which are, you know, various incarnations of native monetization. Traditionally, for consumer tech companies, you see this time and again, what a company will do is they build something, they start receiving traction. And if they're very fortunate, they've either raised so much money or they have such patient investors that they'll continue to invest money into a product, despite, you know, no monetization, or they'll resort to banner ad. And most everybody wants to do native monetization ultimately with their product because the users actually like it. You're actually making serious revenue rather than the shitty pennies on a dollar that you'll put up with from banners. It really is like one of these, like, all around, you get results that are better for everybody. But historically what happens is you can't invest in your native monetization. And look at Facebook. That's a great example of a company that said, hey, we're going to put off our native monetization for years, right?
All right, but you're saying that this is all to say you couldn't put it off. You wanted to make some money with this. Your server costs were starting to get high. You had no outside investors at the time, right?
That's correct.
Banners didn't work because people are so fixated on the game that they're not looking at the banners. What's one other thing that you tried?
So, I tried many things with various success. One thing that failed was subscribers. So that's a typical,
what do you mean subscribers? Getting people to pay for next level or something?
Like a monthly fee, you know, okay. Right? And, that's a very, common monetization technique for, MMOs in, mm-hmm. in the US. And I thought, okay, let me see if I can, you know, do some experiments there. Not at all a successful technique. I also experimented with, a dual currency system wherein you have one currency you can earn through the game, another that you actually pay real money for. And then you use virtual goods and buffs and different opportunities to kind of limit the gameplay. That came about through, being inspired. And, you know, that was not a unique kind of idea. That was actually something that was very common at the time in the East, right? And so I looked at companies like Nexon and these other, you know, gaming companies. I was like, okay, that's how they do it. They have these free-to-play games.
Why didn't it work for you?
Oh, it did. Actually,
I'm sorry. Did okay.
Subscribers did not, but using kind of the MMO, you know, approach like you see with World of Warcraft and EverQuest, that type of approach didn't work for my games. But doing virtual goods and a dual currency system absolutely did.
Do you remember one virtual good that was especially profitable?
Yeah, we had a it was a super chainsaw. So we had, I know it's ridiculous, but there was a normal chainsaw, and then there was a chainsaw that was a more higher power, much more high powered, and that chainsaw cost, I think it was $1.99, right?
I see.
And we had this currency that you had to buy. It was, depending on the game, one of them had like gems, and one had rubies, and one had, you know, all this sort of thing. And people would pay significant amounts of real money for these items. I also allowed you to buy your in-game currency with it, with real money. So you could buy, you know, if you just wanted to be impatient and say, I don't want to earn, you know, even though this one currency can be earned through gameplay, I just want to purchase it.
Okay.
And the most popular item that you could buy with real currency that people actually would pay real money for was the chicken suit. So it was not at all a...
So far it looks like you're onto something. Why try to invent a new process or try to create a whole new business if you're already selling directly to your users?
Right. So one of the things that I had happening is I had several brands approaching me because not surprisingly, the demo of Facebook at that time was, you know, late 2007 was largely, a younger generation. Getting their attention is hard.
Teens and 20s.
Yep, exactly. And so I had a lot of brands approaching me, you know, asking actually, you know, if they could, you know, have something within the gameplay and that sort of thing. And so so before, you know, I was running these experiments in parallel because I frankly could not afford for any one of them to, or for me to fail on one and then say, oh, I need to move on to the next. So I was running all of them at the same time. And I found actually that one of the things that was really, really amazing to me is that, like, you know, virtual goods takes it to a certain level. But then if I had a branded virtual good, that I could actually charge more for a branded item and then even sell more of those. Because for those branded items, there's an emotional attachment that users have to these real world items. Mm-hmm. And it's no mistake. In most games, you see things that seem similar to real world items, right? But they're not. It's, you know, it's something you're like, well, that looks kind of like Mountain Dew, or that looks like it's inspired by Coca-Cola,
right.
But it's not actually Coca-Cola. That's not an accident. That's game designers saying, well, I want to tap into this emotional connection that people have with Coca-Cola. But Coca-Cola hasn't, you know, sanctioned this. So I'm going to make something that, you know, kind of, you know, inspires the thoughts of Coca-Cola, which
okay.
is a very powerful thing that Coca-Cola has spent, you know, over 100 years and a lot of money making us feel that way when we think about Coca-Cola. So I did a few of these branded deals, and the crazy thing is I actually generated more revenue from product placement deals than from virtual goods.
Really?
When I, yeah.
How did you even know who to contact, and how did you know how to convert, how to convince one of those people to buy an ad from you?
I had absolutely no clue what I was doing. I had inbound interest though. So from a, from the perspective of, you know, okay, I have to learn and I have to figure this out. I was, like I said, just highly motivated. And so as people reached out to me, I was, you know,
I mean, someone at a company like McDonald's would reach out to you and say, I see your players are eating fries and burgers. I would like them to eat McDonald's fries and burgers. I see a truck driving through your game. I would like that truck to be one of our McDonald's trucks. Really?
Yeah. Typically what would happen actually though, is it wasn't like, typically what I had to do was I had to change the conversation. What people would reach out to me, and what I saw more often than not was not, hey, I want product placement in your game. The vast majority of people that reached out to me actually were saying, hey, could you build me a game, right? They would say, you know, because they were like, wow, you know, you're one guy in your living room, you have 50 million people playing your game obsessively, you know, would you do that for McDonald's, or would you do
okay.
that for this film studio? And what I... you know, what I did, you know, initially my reaction to that was like, no, I of course not, you know, sorry, no time, best of luck, you know, but I don't do that type of stuff. What I started doing as I realized, you know, the opportunity was with virtual goods was really starting to take hold with my users. What I started doing is I said, you know, as those inbound interests came to me, I said, well, actually, while I don't do the thing you're asking for, check this out. You know, what your goal is it's to reach this huge audience. They're already being reached through this game. If you are integrated into the game and you become part of it and you become an item in the store that the users can buy, then I can guarantee you, yes, you're going to get 50 million people interacting with your brand the day it goes live.
I see.
And so that kind of helped shortcut the process for them, right? And so
who's the first customer that said yes to that?
It was one of the film studios. I don't remember which. I'd have to look back up on it. But
was it for a movie that was coming out?
Yeah, it was for a horror film. And I don't remember if it was one of the Resident Evil movies or if it was for 30 Days of Night or one of the very successful product placement deals we did was with a movie called Funny Games. Don't know if you ever saw it, but very dark film that had two young men in a wealthy neighborhood walking around with a set of golf clubs. And when they use these golf clubs to hold, you know, families hostage and rob them and torture them. It was a very dark film. And we had the golf club in our store. You could buy the golf club from the movie, and users went nuts for it. And the reaction from the studio is just unlike any other type of thing they'd seen. Because for them, you know, to get 50 million people to actually interact with a banner, you would need nearly 50 billion people on the planet, because the click-through rates on banners are so abysmally low that you actually cannot reach that large of an audience with a banner.
You told our pre-interviewer here at Mixergy that you tested out an early version of this product with a small group of angel investors. What was the early version that you tested out with these angel investors?
Our proof of concept was so lightweight. We actually had this, I'm so glad that I don't have to show people this game anymore. So we had this very, very lightweight game that, you know, was like a side scroller. And it had, we had the ability to, upload an image, from my phone and could turn it into a product in the game. And, but these are still like flat two-dimensional objects.
I see. You just wanted to show them, here's how easy it would be or should be to get a product into the game. I could just take a picture of the product and put it into the game. I see. You were just showing them how to get a product image into the game.
Yeah. And that was enough for, you know, some investors to say, okay, I see where this is going. Love it. I understand the problem. Because additionally, even though I had, you know, really good money coming from these deals, one of the painful things that started to happen is we struggled with a lot of the expectations in terms of getting our production timelines to line up. So we had, you know, some of these these agencies reaching out to us saying, hey, please put this deal together. We want it to go live next week. And for us, you know, next week was impossible. It's like, look, it doesn't matter if everybody drops everything and focuses on this. We need, you know, easily a month, because this is not something we can just turnkey. We have to, you know, write custom code for each one of these deals, and we have to, you know, make sure we maintain someone, you know, someone has to be devoted to the campaign, and someone has to, you know, pull all the stats for you. None of it was kind of like out of the box, which, you know, I realize it sounds silly, like pulling stats sounds like that should be a simple thing, but it wasn't, because we had this beautiful dashboard that would tell you everything about every virtual good and who viewed it in the last 24 hours and who interacted with it in what ways and all those results. But that was part of an internal access only dashboard.
So only you could see it, but your sponsor couldn't.
Yeah. And so, you know, if someone gives you $500,000 to put their product in your game, it's a very reasonable question to ask, how's that doing?
Blake, did you get that kind of deal size back then?
Yeah.
When you were running an independent game company.
Yeah.
This was just for you. Someone would pay you $500,000?
We had, at the time, we'd expanded the team. So we had, I think, 3 or 4 people at that time.
I mean, just for your app.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then at what point did you decide, I need to start making this available to other game makers?
So it was years later, honestly, because what we struggled with is we could only do so many of those deals a year. And because it would require, it would take a huge amount of resources, right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that, it was very painful. And that became the motivation for, you know, something like this should exist, which is, you know, a system should automate this, right? This should be as easy as buying banners, but, you know, actually effective. And for us, we couldn't focus and build that system because our core competency was building games, right? And so you can imagine, you know, just imagine, you know, we're building games and it's like, hey, wouldn't it be awesome if there was a platform that did this other thing? Well, we don't have the resources to do that too. We have to stay focused. So it was actually many years later, as I had more and more conversations with other game developers that would, you know, express the same, you know, frustrations in terms of, you know, we did a deal with this shoe company. The users loved it. We made a ridiculous, you know, amount of money. We could actually sell the branded items for extra money because, you know, when players have the option between putting generic sneakers on their basketball player or putting Nike Air Jordans, they were like, I'll pay, you know, $3 for the Jordans instead of 99 cents for generic sneakers. And the brand, you know, had, you know, I had, you know, success story after success story of people going like, oh man, Nike won't leave me alone. They just want, you know, or, you know, Nike example, I don't remember if it was actually Nike, but, you know, customers that were incredibly happy, users that were incredibly happy, developers are incredibly happy. But time and again, people were like, I just can't do this at scale. I can't spend all my time on branded deals. I have to be building games. And
did you split the company up at that time?
No, actually, what I ended up doing is sold. So I ended up selling the company that I built around those games. And then I spent a little bit of time, you know, talking to other game developers and realized, like, this is such a huge problem that I can't believe nobody has built anything in this space yet. And while a few people, I say, you know, nobody had built any space. Some people had made some inroads. You saw historically some companies that attacked the console market, like Massive and Double Fusion. And then a few people that, built very successful companies like AppSavvy, where they would broker these deals, right? And they actually, initially AppSavvy didn't build any technology. They simply said, look, there's so much, you know, demand and supply, and this is, you know, a difficult marriage to make happen, that they would, you know, broker these deals and take a percentage. But they didn't build any technology to automate something that they were actually doing a phenomenal job selling. So we came in with, you know, the thesis of, look, this isn't just a sales play and this isn't just a technology play. This is actually a marriage of the two. And you have to build something that is highly scalable and has, you know, amazing technology. And you have to use that to empower a very, very talented sales team to manage these brand relationships. Because, you know, if you, you know, if you go up to Naked Communications, which is the agency of record for Coca-Cola, and you say, you know, hey, I've built this amazing, beautiful dashboard. You never have to talk to a person again. You can just use this dashboard to do everything you ever wished for. That's great, but that's not how the world works. And, you know, quite frankly, if someone's spending $500,000 with you, and they say, well, you know, we're representing Coca-Cola. We'd like to talk to a human being. That's a very reasonable request and one that you absolutely should honor. And, you know, you have companies like Google is a great example of that, where AdSense is an amazing self-serve product, but they still have a sales team, right? And they still manage relationships and they still, you know, have very, very big clients that,
I see.
You know,
that can. Let me ask you a question, just going back to something you said earlier. You said you sold the game company, or I guess it was a collection of companies?
So it was actually a collection of games around one company, and I sold those games to a company that I ended up as co-founder, and joined as a co-founder. It was a company.
Is this D's Ohai. Games?
That was called Ohai, actually.
Ohai, okay.
Yeah, and Ohai was, you know, honestly, very early on this concept of doing mid-core games. You know, we brought some of the team from EverQuest, from out of Sony Online Entertainment, joined the company, and we were building mid-core games very early. This was.
Did you sell for cash or for equity in the business?
A mixture.
Mixture.
Yeah.
So how much cash did you get from selling your business?
I don't think that's ever been announced.
Over $1 million?
And never announced it. But I don't have any intention of doing so. But obviously, you know, what's a good way to put it? I've had a few base hits in my life and that's
and that
great.
Was a base hit.
Yeah.
And then the company had to close?
That company ultimately did close. Yeah. Okay. I think, you know, frankly, we were really too early on the mid-core market. And we also made games that were probably a little bit more hardcore than the mid-core market had an appetite for. So while we were right in identifying opportunity, I think we still made the gameplay a little bit too hardcore.
Actually, you know what? Before I get into this next line of questioning, because it's really important, let me say thank you to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. What do you think of the way that I embed my advertiser into my interviews?
I think that's fantastic, right? I mean, I think, you know, drinking from a coffee cup that, you know, has a logo on and that sort of thing is, what's a good way to put it? Like, product placement has a long storied set of, you know, kind of like successes. Like, you know, the film industry, ever since, like, what was it, E.T. and the Reese's Pieces, right?
Reese's Pieces and with this mug, everybody has to be exposed to the same sponsor. Everyone has to see Reese's Pieces because Steven Spielberg couldn't take it in and out as he wanted to. I can't change mugs. With your software, you have to, I guess, have a blank mug and then allow the sponsor to only buy the number of impressions that she wants, right? And have each ad appear beautifully in place. We'll get back to the sponsor in a moment. How did you do that? How did you allow them to go in and test and then get stats and then come back when they need to?
So the way we do that is we have an SDK that's embedded in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it passes, you know, like a set of parameters and says, you know, hey, here's the parameters that are relevant to this user, right? And usually it's, you know, it's a random user ID that doesn't let us, personally identify the user. But if we know something about them, like say if we know a gender, if we know their age range or something like that, then we can do targeting. Now, you actually don't always want that level of targeting though. Because imagine this, if you and I are playing a game, but we're in separate demographics because we live on, you know, different coasts, right? While our technology does enable the possibility to say, all right, you know, for me, this drink appears as a Pepsi, but for you, it appears as a Gatorade, that can create a jarring experience, right? I mean, especially if I gift it, right? Like if I give you a Pepsi, but it turns into a Gatorade because we're in different demographics, that's very jarring, right? So what, and suddenly, you know, what may sound like conceptually a very interesting thing to do ends up resulting in not a game that's more fun, right? So while that is possible, we usually push advertisers only to do that in scenarios that are signage, right? So if you're you know, in a racing game and the billboards are different for you and for me, that's acceptable, right?
But if the store facing those billboards is McDonald's for me and Burger King for you, that's awkward.
It's very odd because what if we're playing together and I'm saying meet me at the Burger King and you're like, I don't see one. Right? Suddenly that's very, very jarring and very
strange. But also a billboard can be easily changed, right? When you're talking about a truck that you put a Mountain Dew ad on sometimes, and other times a Geico ad, and other times a, what else do you have? Red Bull and so on. Does that mean that a designer has to design all these different trucks for the sponsors?
Right now, yes. But those are just textures. In the case of most of these games, we're just overlaying textures over a product, right? And I say we're just as though it's a trivial thing to do. So it's absolutely, you know, it's a good amount of tech work to make that happen. What we aren't doing is we're not simply saying, oh, upload a logo, and then we automatically create, you know, given like, you know, vector art, we don't automatically create these objects from, you know, canonical representations of them, but that's where we're headed, right? With our, you know, it would not surprise anyone, you know, if they looked at our product roadmap to say, oh, wow, if someone can just upload like a set of like core assets for a brand, and then for us to generate, you know, all of the type of, you know, relevant objects that may be, you know, necessary from that automatically. So the nice thing is it, you know, while there is right now some artist work necessary, it's very little. It's on the order of, you know, we're talking somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes the vast majority of the time in terms of artwork, which is absolutely, you know, which is inconsequential compared to the typical story of 6 to 8 weeks before we can integrate you into our game, right? You know, taking 6 to 8 weeks down to 30 minutes is heroic, right? 30 minutes is still too long for us. So ultimately, we're going to have it instantaneous.
All right, I'll tell you about this mug. This mug is from Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. He is the startups entrepreneur. I've done ads for him now for weeks where I've held up this mug. And James Ashenhurst in the audience said, Andrew, I don't like the way you're doing these ads. You should do it a little bit differently. So I said, okay. What do you mean? And he said, you know, Andrew, a few weeks ago, you did an interview with a guy named Eric Bond, where he said that he formed an LLC because it was the easiest option, but that he paid a lot more in taxes because Eric didn't have any idea what qualified small business stock was. And so James, the listener, says you need to tell people stories like that, scare them into paying attention that they need to talk to lawyers at some point in their development of their company so that they don't make big mistakes like that. So I'm taking James's advice. I'm telling you Eric's story. And I'm suggesting that if you don't have a lawyer and you're a tech entrepreneur in the startup space, that you at least send an email over to Scott. Well, here's his email. Scott@walkercorporatelaw.com, or check out walkercorporatelaw.com and see the collection of testimonials from people who we all respect who say this is the guy to talk to. Walkercorporatelaw.com. Can your trucks do that, Blake?
Can they
speak? Can they take criticism from the audience?
Yeah, you know, honestly.
Really?
And like any other, like really our system is object agnostic. We can do audio. We can do video. We can do textures. We can do 3D images. It's really any type of object we can deliver dynamically.
Now, so James Ashenhurst, please play one of Blake's games and shoot him an email and tell him how he could do it differently.
Yeah, I mean, you know, any form of advertising, you can overreach with, right? And, you know, some people are going to respond to it negatively. Some, I mean, you know, frankly, you know, if somebody absolutely does not like a particular brand and we present that brand to them, chances are it's not going to change their opinion about that brand, right? Now, the nice thing is, you know, if you do it in a subtle enough manner, then you're going to still present them with, you know, at least a moment of like, well, this feels more realistic, right? I've brought more realism into this, even if they don't have an affinity for that specific brand. But you can think of examples of this, you know, of overreach in any type of advertising, product placement in film. You can probably think of a few examples where you're like, well, that didn't feel embedded. That actually, that felt just like I was being advertised to, right? And, you know, and that's, I think, you know, that's where it's not a matter of science anymore. It's a matter of, you know, an art, right? Because you can look at, here's a great example of this, watching a James Bond film, right? You know, you may have Audi or Mercedes or whoever may be, you know, take, you know, BMW maybe taking out, you know, the ad that says, okay, we want the car in this movie. Those type of product placements, you have that car featured for, you know, sometimes 20 minutes of the film, right? It's amazing.
Yeah.
Which sounds like, you know, you could say there's a hard and fast rule of no product can appear for more than 30 seconds or else users are going to assume just they're being advertised to, but it absolutely is fine in the context of the James Bond film. Now, you know, if you tried to do that in many other types of movies, chances are it would be very strange. Like if you had a romantic comedy that centered around the BMW for 20 minutes, you know, I'm confident everyone yes. This is very odd. And so it's, you know,
let me ask you this question, because I know I have limited time with you. And there's one thing that we said earlier that I have to get back to. The company ultimately failed and we brushed it off and I moved on to MediaSpike, but I don't want to get past this. The psychology, the personal setback or the feelings of failures that come from that. You talked to April Dykeman, our producer. She asked you about what's one thing that you would teach entrepreneurs about if you could. And you said, you know what? It wouldn't be the how-to stuff. It would be the psychology. It would be about how to manage your emotions. So now we've got a point in your story where we can talk about that. Tell me before you get to how you get past it, what did it feel like when you had that setback, when this business that you were a part of failed?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's so hard to separate yourself as a founder from a company, and mm-hmm. it's so hard to not take failure incredibly personal, right? I mean, it's hard. I mean, just when you're raising money, not to take it personal, right? Because, you know, you're pouring your heart and soul into something. It's your baby and it's beautiful. And, you know, it's tough when someone says, "Hey, actually, your baby's hideous, right? I hate it. It's not worth a penny, right?" You know, it was sleepless nights, difficulty eating, all of the traditional.
Which period was this where you had the sleepless nights and tough time eating?
As it was clear to me that Ohio was going to fail.
And like when you would wake up in the middle of the night or not be able to go to sleep, what would you think about?
I would struggle with what do we need to do different, and also it's so hard not to do this. I would review my mistakes, right? You know, ultimately you've learned from them, but it's so hard not to dwell on them.
And what's a mistake that you dwelled on?
Let's see. One of the worst mistakes I dwelled on is I was less active in the fundraising process as one of the founders than I wish I had been. I wish I had actually taken control of that process and that I had been the one prioritizing that. Instead, I was ancillary and simply, I was like, "Look, I'll show up for the meetings. I'll do my pitch, and then I want to get back to building product." And really and truly, it's just building out those relationships and really focusing on that. While at the time it was not something I wanted to do, I absolutely see the value of doing that. Right.
It impact your performance that you were thinking about how you should have done that or should have done the other thing?
It's a horrible distraction, right? And I think that the name of the game, I think too many people look at startups in terms of it's how many hours I can deliver and devote to the company, but that's not nearly as important as actually your throughput in terms of how much you actually get done and accomplish. And it's when you're stressed out, your performance suffers. And most people simply try to throw hours at the problem, right? And that doesn't necessarily bring you better results, right? So I, over the years, one of the things I've really, really spent a lot of time focusing on is how do I manage my own psychology and my own struggles? We very recently finished a fundraising event and fundraising can be an emotional struggle for a lot of founders. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've always loved is, the common, understanding that people say, we invest in teams, not ideas, not companies. We fixate on the team, right? It's you. All right. And that's very encouraging when you hear that, cause you're like, wow, this person, it's me, they're going to be inspired by. And so then when someone passes, it's hard not to take that personal because you're like, right. Wait a minute, if you only invest in people and you're passing, then clearly it's me. That's right. It's very hard not to take that personal.
Is there one person who you especially resent or feel like I've got to show him?
No, absolutely not.
I had one of those people. I definitely had one of those people. My entrepreneurship professor, I went to him and I said, I need some help here. I don't know how to raise money and I don't know what I'm doing, but I think I'm onto something. And he pulled me aside and he basically said, this just isn't going to work. What you need to do is, and then he showed me these companies that he was advising, said, you need to be more like them. And I was so glad when the big company that he told me he was advising failed. So I said, that son of a bitch, that's who he loved. Good. Let him suffer with them. For years, as I was building my company, I said, I went from periods of thinking, what if he's right and I don't know anything and I never will fit in this world, to more often thinking, I'm going to show him. I got to show him. But I'm sorry, let's go back to that point where the business was failing. You were questioning yourself. I'm curious about how it impacted your day-to-day activities. Did it keep you from getting to work on time? Did it keep you from coming up with new ideas? What did it keep you from doing?
It absolutely killed my creativity.
Okay.
That's one of the first to go. Like creativity is, it's so hard to schedule creativity. And when you're, doing game design and building games, like killing your creativity is a bullet to the head for the company.
Right? I see.
And one of the things that I struggled with is, allocating enough time to make sure I, was getting enough rest and getting enough exercise and getting enough, making sure I was eating well and that sort of thing. What's always difficult about that is when a company is struggling, devoting time to anything but the company made me feel an enormous amount of guilt. Like, awful guilt. I was just like, I can't believe I'm at the gym. Shame on me for not getting work done.
And meanwhile, the gym might have helped you think more clearly and more positively, more creatively at work.
Absolutely. And it's very hard to, you know, we all know that. Like, everybody knows. I mean, like, I don't need to tell you that you need to eat more vegetables, right? You know that, right? I mean, well, I don't know what your personal diet is like, but I don't need to tell you that you need to eat vegetables. And I don't need to tell you that, like, hey, it's in the best interest of your health for you to get more sleep. You know, everybody knows this. It's really hard to enact on because the short-term burst of productivity you can get by just saying, like, well, I just have to work late tonight. I'll go to the gym tomorrow is such an easy lie to tell yourself, you know, at the sacrifice of, you know, your long-term health, your long-term stress level.
What about your ability to make deals or to come up with creative solutions to your problems because of the way you're feeling?
I think that was absolutely impacted. And it's very difficult to quantify, right?
Yeah.
You can look back and say, ah, here's what I would have done differently. But, you know, would I have done certain things differently if I had been, you know, more attentive to my health? That's not necessarily clear, right? Because, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but you don't necessarily know that, like, all right, would I have had, you know, that you know, level, the appropriate level of vision necessary for that company if I had been, you know, more attentive to my health?
I was going to ask you, what do you do to snap out of that? Because now we see the danger of it, but you can't just say, hey, you know what? This makes no sense. I'm going to stop feeling bad. I'm going to be okay.
So I'm a huge believer in cognitive dissonance, because people don't always believe what they say. They focus on a perception, right? And, you know, one of the things that's really nice is trying to, you know, convince yourself of something again and again. Like, you know, it's, you know, if you had looked at me 15 years ago, what I was saying is like, okay, I want to meet, you know, a very nice young woman that, you know, isn't going to introduce any, like, you know, difficulties into my life. And I want someone that is kind, that is, you know, going to be, you know, affectionate, someone that's intelligent, someone
yep.
that is, you know, all these, you know, very wonderful, you know, characteristics. But if you then look at what I actually did and, you know, the what I actually pursued as far as a relationship goes, I clearly was not consistent, right? And I think that, understanding, you know, your own faults and your own shortcomings really helps you to change and manage your own psychology. Because if you say, all right, if these things are legitimately too important to me, I need to not just say them. I need to actually execute them. Because people say things all the time. Right, I can tell you, you have to get exercise a few times a week if you want to manage, you know, if you want to have a healthy heart. But actually doing it is difficult. And so one of the things I do personally is, you know, I set frames of reference for myself. So one thing, like, I know that, you know, many, many people grew up from, you know, modest means and then move on to, you know, use, you know, startups and or build startups and that sort of thing. But one of the things I've reminded myself throughout my career is that, you know, being broke and being bankrupt in America is not that bad. You know, the worst thing that would ever happen to me when a company fails is I might have to work at a job I don't love, which is ridiculously lucky by any other
standpoint. So saying what's the worst thing that could happen and recognizing that the worst thing that can happen is not so bad. If the worst thing that can happen is you go bankrupt, hell, I've had friends go bankrupt. Life goes on, right? And you get out from under that weight. If the worst thing that can happen is you go get a job, yeah, the entrepreneurship blogosphere says that's the worst thing ever. But frankly, getting a job is not the worst thing ever, especially if you work for someone who's good and inspiring, you end up better off for it.
How many people, like, you know, hate their job or even worse, have difficulty getting one, right?
So I mean, being aware of what those thoughts are that you might be hiding from and then challenging them a little bit and saying, okay, what am I afraid of? Oh, yeah, it's that I'm going to go bankrupt. Is that so bad? Actually, yeah. It's not so bad. I see. And that's the thing that helped you snap out of it.
Yeah. And I mean, there's no such thing. I remind people, you know, like, look, there's bankruptcy, but then that's it. There's no such thing as super bankruptcy, right? You know, it's not like someone then says, wait a minute, you went super bankrupt. So now
I'm going to take a spleen. You know,
you're not allowed to ever start a company.
Right.
You know, right. That doesn't happen, right? You are. You know, one of the things that I managed, you know, from my own psychology, actually, as I started thinking about things is, I started from a set of exercises where I rationalize and justify things that I wanted myself to do, because I said, okay, I want myself to take care of my health, but I'm not, And I say it's important, and I understand this. And so I started from a set of assumptions, very simple ones. One of them, everybody agrees with, which is, if you take care of your health, in terms of getting rest, eating well, and getting exercise, if you do those things, your throughput is higher, right? And that's true, yeah. Right? Your health is better, yes. And your throughput is higher. And, the goal of a startup is for me to maximize my productivity and my throughput. It's not to maximize the hours I work. So with those two things, I'm like, okay, so the next logical step is for me to say to myself, part of my job is to maximize my throughput. Because I owe that to the company. I owe that to the team that I have to do as much as I get as much done as I possibly can. So I then worked backwards and I said, all right, well, I want to have, beer and hot wings tonight for dinner, but it's my job to make sure I eat spinach and grilled chicken, right? And when you start convincing yourself and reminding yourself that it's your job to go to the gym and it's your job to get enough rest, it is uncanny. It took some time because I had to work on myself and I had to convince myself of these things, but it's amazing how powerful that becomes when you're like, you're exhausted and you're like, I just want to grab some fast food real quick. And you're like, it's my job to not eat fast food. It's very, very, powerful. So that's personally how I manage my own psychology. And there are other things you can do, but I think that, that's what I found works really, really well for me.
One of your heroes, Mark Andreessen, he invested in your business. Mm-hmm. How did you get him as an investor?
One of the guys from Plaxo, a gentleman named John McCray, he's our COO, had actually known Mark Andreessen for years from the Netscape days. John was actually at Silicon Graphics, and at that time he saw the power of the web, and Mark Andreessen was very much so poster child at that time for Netscape and the whole internet revolution. Once John joined the team, actually he reached out to Mark saying, hey, coincidentally I joined this team, love to show it to you. And because of that relationship, because Mark had known John for years, trusted him, and they were friends, that allowed me to get a meeting that I frankly probably would not have been able to get, right? Because Mark is incredibly busy, and there's a lot of entrepreneurs trying to get his time, right? Mm-hmm. And say, let me show you my baby. So there's a particularly interesting kind of moment for me. Because and Mark doesn't know this, right? If he sees this interview, eventually he's going to hear this story, and I hope he laughs. So Mark was a personal hero of mine because while I was in college, that's when Netscape was kind of like fighting Microsoft, right? And it's hard not to love the underdog, especially when it's a software underdog. And I was a computer science major, so Mark is this icon of. I am fighting Microsoft single-handedly, and of course that's not the scenario, but there's
the way it felt to us, and Microsoft felt like they were applying a lot of pressure.
Oh yeah, and they're picking on this guy, but he's a brilliant software person, and he's going to win. And I mean, it was so inspiring, and I not the only one I think at that time, and we actually had a in school, just the extent of my kind of looking up to Mark. As a hero, I was lead developer on a project within school where we were actually building a web browser. And this speaks to both my, I think, hero worship and maybe my own narcissism in that the name of the project was NetBlake. The rest of the team did not think it was funny. I thought it was the most clever pun ever. Bit of homage, but also probably a bit of arrogance on my part. That kind of like, I think illustrates the extent of how much I was just obsessed with Netscape and with their success. It's a very dangerous thing. The saying goes, don't meet your heroes because you're going to be disappointed. What you've built up in your mind of who they are is always better than the actual person. Because people are flawed, right? Your heroes are flawless for all intents and purposes. And I have to say, this is one of those cases where, meeting Mark was not at all disappointing. The man is incredibly intelligent, incredibly nice. and very insightful and very warm.
And the story that he doesn't know is that you tried to compete with him when you were in school, creating your own Netscape knockoff.
We weren't actually competitive. It was simply for school as a project. So we never.
What was the name of the browser?
It was called Netlake. So a play on the word Netscape.
Can you say it again? Because the connection keeps dropping.
Oh, it's NetBlake. So N-E-T and then my name, right?
Oh, NetBlake. So, okay. Yeah. It keeps cutting out for some reason. I thought you were saying NetBlink. I see.
So, yeah.
Well, somebody please email Mark Andreessen and tell him that please position it as a competition.
I have no doubt that Netscape was taking on Microsoft. I'm pretty sure my three college kids company would have had a tougher time.
He started in college too with web browsers.
That's true with Mozilla and all that.
And I've got a feeling that someone right now is in the audience listening to you, maybe on their way to a job interview with you, maybe as they're trying to figure out how to work with you. Maybe it's 20 years in the future and they're trying to figure out how to get you as an investor the way that you are interested in getting Mark Andreessen. And when they come and talk to you, what's the one thing you hope they took away from this conversation? What's the one thing that will make you feel like this is an intelligent person?
I think that we all have a limited amount of time to learn from our own mistakes, right? And I think that one of the things I tend to look for is, of course, domain expertise is important, and understanding the scope of your problem, customers, et cetera, and all that sort of thing is important. But a willingness to learn from the mistakes of others, I think, is what really, really will set apart the people that are great. Because if you don't learn from your own mistakes, you suck, right? Like, you're just fucking stupid if you don't learn from your own mistakes, right? Like, it doesn't matter what else you may do. Like, you could be the luckiest guy in the world, but if you're not learning from your mistakes, like, you're going to blow it eventually. So learning from your own mistakes is kind of like, that's the bar, right? Like, if you're not learning from your own mistakes, you're done. But then being able to learn from the mistakes of others is an amazing kind of, competitive advantage that very few people seem to really leverage. And that's why I think that, one of the things that is unique about Silicon Valley is that so many people do share their failure stories. And those failure stories have two purposes, really, that most people feel, they don't seem to really capture either one of those. They don't seem to grasp, the purposes behind sharing your failure story. They simply say, like, oh, it must be misery loves company, right? Or, you're in this accepting environment. And, one very important aspect to that is, by hearing these failure stories, it certainly does give you that perspective that I think is so important as a person, which is, the entrepreneur journey is a lonely one. If you've never experienced loneliness, you're the luckiest human being on the planet. If you want a giant fucking cup of it, actually a cup is, if you want a giant swimming pool full of it that you're trapped in the middle of for, every day and night for years and years, start a company. Because you will never be more lonely in your life than as a founder of a company. And you have to manage yourself. And to hear other people say, it was hard. And it was difficult and it was stressful and I was upset and, it just killed my health. I think that's important for people to hear because it helps them understand that their own struggle is acceptable and that they're not even more lonely than they already feel. The second, I'm sorry.
I want to hear the second, but I've got to say to the audience, I did a series called the Fail Series, Fail, F-A-I-L, with entrepreneurs who are willing to spend an hour telling me very openly about their failures. One entrepreneur talked about what kept him from actually taking action. He had this idea and he failed. I asked him why. And as we listened to the story, we could tell it's because he was too afraid to take action. Another entrepreneur was part of the Grasshopper group. These are the guys who make that phone number, Grasshopper, really experienced company. Great entrepreneurs. They launched a business that failed. They talked about that. I see a $40 million company that failed. James Altucher talked about how he was losing $1 million every week. These are entrepreneurs who, like Blake said, are willing to be open about their failures. I urge you to listen to them and learn from their mistakes so you don't make the same thing and so you learn to think about business. And the way to do that is just go to Mixergy, M-I-X-E-R-G-Y, the site that we're hosting this interview on, and type in Fail Series, and you'll see entrepreneurs who volunteered to be part of the series that I did. Learn from them. It's really powerful. I'm glad that you said that. But I was about to cut you off. You're about to say a second thing. What was that?
Well, And that second part is exactly what you're alluding to, which is, you know, by learning from those mistakes, you can absolutely, you know, propel your business and your own, like, understanding your own personal growth much, much faster, which is a huge competitive advantage. Like, I don't have to make all the mistakes in order to become a better entrepreneur. By knowing these stories and by them being shared with me, I can say, oh, wow, in the instance of this happening, I should make sure I don't make the same mistake that person did, right? And you know, that I think is a huge competitive advantage. And that willingness to learn from the failures of others rather than simply dismiss it as that person sucked. Like, I have made so many mistakes that other people had made before me. And had I known their own stories, I would have learned much faster. And I would probably be, you know, far more successful.
Are you willing to say what your revenues are now at Media Spike?
Media Spike, we're not sharing that just yet.
Are you guys over a million?
we're gonna have announcements next year.
Next year. Here's what I've got. Just around 25 million unique users are engaging with the ads, or seeing the ads at least. That's over what, since the beginning or per month?
Per month, right?
Per month. Okay, so yeah, 25 million unique people are seeing the ads per month. 50 to 90% of them are engaging with the ads in some way, either driving a truck or maybe jumping up and down on a Pepsi Cola vending machine or something like that. That's what we're talking about.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Banner ads clearly don't get that kind of interaction. All right, let me ask you this final question. Sorry, we're losing the connection, so I'm glad this is the final question. I hate when the connection starts to die. The final question is this. I'm looking for more people to interview. Who do you know and admire and want to learn from that I should be doing an interview with?
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. There's a lot of people out there. I think, you know, honestly, I one of the things that I think I love learning about is, you know, especially lately, is, you know, not just about building companies, but understanding the capital structures that build them as well. So, you know, obviously the investors in our company, I think they're all worth interviewing. You know, very.
Is there one that's lesser known but incredible that I should be talking to?
Lesser known. See, if I start naming names, then they'll feel that they aren't as important. I don't know.
No, not as, like, you know what? There's some marquee names like Mark Andreessen. No question about it. I love hearing his story, and I've read it for years, especially that Business Week article, the cover story years ago. Yeah. But there's some people who don't get that kind of attention who are nevertheless very impressive. Yeah. Do you want to take it offline?
People that haven't been on Business Week that I know are incredibly brilliant. How's that?
Yes.
And I think, you know, some guys like I absolutely love every conversation I have with Jeremy Liu over at Lightspeed.
Okay.
And Lightspeed's not an investor in us. So I have nothing but, you know, good things to say about him. And he has, he has fantastic insight. He's been very successful. He's still incredibly nice and humble, right? Just despite his success, which says a lot about his character as a person. Then of course, like, one of the people I love talking to, that is one of our investors through Raptor Capital is a gentleman named Robert Goldberg. He's fantastic. He was, I believe corp dev at Zynga, which makes for some incredibly interesting war stories, right? And you know, when you have someone that, you know, like I said, I think the people that have been, you know, operational and then do, build companies are incredibly interesting to talk to, because they kind of get this holistic picture on the industry. Saad Khan is one of our investors from CMEA. The man has just an amazing amount of insight. Love having the opportunity to work with him. And then as far as other entrepreneurs, this is always tough. One of the guys I love talking to, mostly because I love gaming, is Damon Groh. He's a brilliant game designer, incredible energy. If I could figure out how to, you know, harness the power of his adrenal gland, I would never need another cup of coffee. I'm trying to think of, you know, some of the others that I love. Jen Garcia is another one. She's in the gaming industry over at Metamoki. Incredibly intelligent, a lot of great experiences, and I think she can speak to a lot of experiences that I can't, right? I'm an outsider from Silicon Valley, or from originally from Austin. I'm an outsider, not originally part of Silicon Valley. I believe she's from New York, so she has another unique perspective there. I think
Can I follow up
there's
with
a
you
lot.
after this interview and get their
Absolutely.
contact info or
Please,
ask for an
help me with
introduction?
that.
I'd love it.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for doing this interview. The site for everyone who wants to go check out some of these images that I've been talking about, like the truck that can be rebranded as a Coke truck or a McDonald's truck or any number of different ways, all that you can see at mediaspike.com. Blake, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
I love it.